This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. It's a true honor and pleasure to be here tonight at Lannan to introduce one of my favorite writers and dearest friends, Yi-Yun Lee. I should begin by saying that Yi-Yun is a very difficult person to introduce. All of the niceties and the praise and politeness that are usually part of these things, she has no patience for them. She does not waste time on small talk, in person or in her writing. But I hope she will allow me a few of them tonight. I've known Yi-Yun since 2003, when I published her first story in the Paris Review. And a few years later, we started a magazine together called A Public Space. And so in addition to reading her work, these days I also get to talk and argue and laugh with her about writing. It has been enormous fun. Yi-Yun Lee is the author of two books, the novel The Vagrants and the short story collection A Thousand Years of Good Prayers, which won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, the Penn Hemingway Award, the Guardian First Book Award, and the list goes on. A third collection of stories, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, will be published later this year. These books are all the more remarkable when you realize she has only been writing for 12 years. Though she's only at the start of her career, I do believe with these three books, she has already made herself an essential writer. Yi-Yun has said that all good fiction is about how time passes. And this is the first sentence of her first story, Immortality. His story, like the story of every one of us, started long before he was born. I still remember reading that sentence when she sent the story to the Paris Review, and I still think it's a perfect sentence. And ever since then, Yi-Yun has been exploring this theme of how we repeat the stories that came before us and will continue after us. While Yi-Yun isn't an autobiographical writer, she once said that writing is a way to be invisible, to exist in the world without being noticed. Her imagination is anchored in the Beijing she grew up in, waiting in line at the marketplace, the ways private life bleeds into public space, the great gossips and nosy neighbors. She writes wonderfully about those characters who are always interested in other people's business. And while her stories aren't interested in the public life of politics, almost none of her characters are untouched by it. She returns to certain types of people over and over again. Her characters are always in love with the wrong person or the wrong thing. And even when it's the right love, it still turns out wrong. In her earlier stories, these characters resist and rebel against their fate. They try to step out of time. This is how a character from one of the stories in her first collection thinks about it. "Now will be over soon," Sasha said. She looked forward to the moment when she was ready to move on. Moving on was a phrase she just learned, an American concept that suited her well. It was such a wonderful phrase that Sasha could almost see herself stapling her Chinese life, one staple after another around the pages until they became one solid block that nobody would be able to open and read. She would have a fresh page then for her American life. The characters in her newer stories, and she's going to read one of her new stories tonight, are less inclined to fight against fate, to deceive themselves in such way. They aren't passive, but they acknowledge the hostility of the world, its loneliness and sadness. She writes of one character, that he long ago made a decision not to defend himself against this ridiculous world. As a consequence, they tend to remove themselves from everyday life. They find comfort in solitude, but the solitude isn't a way to escape. And this is one of the remarkable qualities of her writing. It's a way to strip away any falseness. These stories put the reader in a dangerous position. We fill up our days with distractions. We invent excuses. We find ways to avoid hard truths. The characters in these stories don't allow themselves or readers any illusions. But as bleak as her stories can be, as one reader said, "I was so excited by a story, so well written and so moving, that I paced around the house jazzed for 30 minutes. To that, I will simply add that her stories are also true." You will see that in the story she is going to read from now. Please join me in welcoming Yi-Yun Lee.
Good evening. Can you hear me? Thank you so much for coming tonight. I just want to say a few words to thank Lianan Foundation. A few years ago, Lianan was very generous and sent me to this writer's retreat in Marfa, Texas. And at the time, my older son was 5, and then my younger son was going to turn 1. And for years and years, I was trying to finish a novel, and I hadn't even started because of the children and work. So I went to Marfa, and I had 19 days there, and I counted my days, and I counted my words of count. So I wrote for 18 days and finished my first draft in Marfa. And so I actually told Joe and Martha yesterday, I said, when I have a dog, I'm going to name my dog Martha. So I'm going to read a new story from the new book. It's quite long. It's a novella-length story, and it's published actually in Bridget's magazine, The Public Space, the latest issue. And just a few things you need to know before I start reading. So the story is about this woman in middle age reflecting about her life. So there are 3 storylines, and 1 storyline I pretty much have to skip, which is when she went to the Chinese army. So a lot of things happened in the army camp. And you would hear a few words about the army, but mostly the part of the story I'm going to read is about her life and her parents and her family life. And the title is Kindness. I'm a 41-year-old woman living by myself in the same one-bedroom flat where I have always lived, in a derelict building on the outskirts of Beijing. Apart from a trip to a cheap seaside resort taken with my parents the summer I turned 5, I have not traveled much. I spent a year in an army camp in central China. But other than that, I've never lived away from home. In college, after a few failed attempts to convince me of the importance of being a community member, my advisor stopped acknowledging my presence, and the bed assigned to me was taken over by the other 5 girls and their trunks. I have not married, and naturally have no children. I have few friends. Though as I have never left the neighborhood, I have enough acquaintances, most of them a generation or 2 older. Being around them is comforting. Never is there a day when I feel that I'm alone in aging. I teach mathematics in the 3rd-tier middle school. I do not love my job or my students, but I have noticed that even the most meager attention I give to the students is returned by a few of them with respect and gratitude, and sometimes inexplicable infatuation. I pity those children more than I appreciate them, as I can see where they are heading in their lives. It is a terrible thing, you see, even for an indifferent person like me, to see the bleakness lurking in someone else's life. I have no hobby that takes me outside my flat during my spare time. I do not own a television set. But I have a room full of books, at least 50 older than I am. I have never in my life hurt a soul, or if I have done any harm unintentionally, the pain I inflicted was the most trivial kind, forgotten the moment it was felt, if indeed it could be felt in any way. But that cannot be a happy life, or much of a life at all, you might say. That may very well be true. Why are you unhappy? To this day, if I close my eyes, I can feel Lieutenant Wei's finger under my chin, lifting my face to a spring night. Tell me, how can we make you happy? The question, put to me 23 years ago, have remained unanswerable. Though it no longer matters. As you see, Lieutenant Wei died 3 weeks ago. At 46, mother of a teenage daughter, wife of a stationary merchant, veteran of Unit 20256, People's Liberation Army, from which she retired at 43, already afflicted with a malignant tumor. She was made her way in the funeral announcement. I do not know why the news of her death was mailed to me, except perhaps that the funeral committee thought I was one of her long-lost friends, my name scribbled in an old address book. I wonder if the announcement would send to the other girls, though not many of them would still be at the same address. I remember the day Lieutenant Wei's wedding invitation arrived in the distance past, and thinking then that it would be the last time I would hear from her. I did not go to the funeral, as I had not gone to her wedding, both of which took place 2 hours by train from Beijing. It is a hassle to travel for a wedding, but more so for a funeral. One has to face strangers' tears, and worse, one has to repeat words of condolence to irrelevant people. When I was 5, a peddler came to our neighborhood one Sunday with a bamboo basket full of spring chicks. I was trailing behind my father for our weekly shopping of ration food, and when the peddler put a chick in my palm, its small body soft and warm, shivering constantly, I cried before I could ask my father to buy it for me. We were not a rich family. My father worked as a janitor, and my mother, ill as long as I could remember, did not work. And I learned early to count coins and small bills with my father before we set out to shop. It must have been a painful thing for those who knew our story to watch my father's distress as two women offered to buy two chicks for me. My father, on the way home, warned me gently that the chicks were too young to last more than a day or two. I built a nest for the chicks out of a shoebox and ripped newspaper and fed them water-softened millet grains. And a day later, when they looked ill, aspirin dissolved in water. 2 days later, they died. The one I named Dot and marked with ink on his forehead, the first to go, followed by Mushroom. I stole 2 eggs from the kitchen when my father went to help a neighbor fix a leaking sink. My mother was not often around in those days. And I cracked the eggs carefully and washed away the yolks and whites. But no matter how hard I tried, I could not fit the chicks back into the shells. And I can see to this day the half shell on Dot's head, covering the ink spot like a funny little hat. I have learned since then that life is like that, each day ending up like a chick refusing to be returned to the eggshell. I'm going to go a few pages later. A dream has recurred over the past 20 years in which I have to give up my present life and return to the army. Lieutenant Wei is in the dream. In the early years, she would smile cruelly at me. Didn't I tell you that you would be back? The question was put to me in various ways, but the coldness remained the same. The dreams had become less wicked as the years have gone by. I'm back, I tell Lieutenant Wei. I always knew you would come back, she replies. We are older, having aged in my dreams as we have in real life, the only remnant of a previous life among a group of chirpy teenage girls. These dreams upset me. Lieutenant Wei's marriage 2 years after I had left the army, and her transfer to another city, which would know her only as a married woman and later a mother, and then would see her die, must have wiped her history clean so she could start collecting new memories, not about young, miserable girls in a camp, but about happy people who deserve to be remembered. I never showed up in her dreams, I'm certain, as people we keep in our memories rarely have a place for us in theirs. You may say that we too evict people from our hearts while we continue living in theirs, and that may very well be true for some people. But I wonder if I'm an anomaly in that respect. I have never forgotten a person who has come into my life. And perhaps it's for that reason I cannot have much of a life myself. The people I carry with me have lived out not only their own rations, but mine too. Though they're an innocent usurpers of my life, and I have only myself to blame. For instance, there's Professor Shan. She was in her early 60s when I met her, but this may be the wrong way to put it, as she had lived in the same neighborhood for as long as my father had. She must have watched my generation grow up and studied every one of us before singling me out. I like to imagine it that way. You see, for a lonely woman, it is hard not to make up some scenario that allows her to believe herself special in some minor way. Professor Shan was in her early 60s, and I was 12 when she approached me on a September evening. I was on my way to the milk station. "Do you have a minute?" she asked. I looked down at the two empty bottles snuggled in the little carrier my father had woven for me. He had painted a dried reed different colors, and the basket had an intricate pattern, though by then the colors had all paled. My father had a pair of hands that were good at making things. The wooden packs he put on the foyer wall for my school satchel and coat had red beaks and black eyes. The cardboard wardrobe had two windows that you could push open from inside. A perfect place for me to hide. He had built my bed too, a small wooden one, painted orange, just big enough to fit into the foyer alongside the wardrobe. We lived in a small one-room unit, the room itself serving as my parents' bedroom, the foyer my bedroom. There was a small cube of kitchen and a smaller cube of bathroom next to the foyer. Later, it occurred to me that we could not afford much furniture, but when I was young, I thought it was a hobby of my father's to make things with his own hands. Once upon a time, he must have made things for my mother, too. But from the time my memory begins, their bedroom had two single beds, my father's bare and neatly made, and my mother's piled with old novels. "Do you have a minute? I'm asking you," the old woman said again. I had developed a look of distractedness by then, and she was not the most patient woman. "I was on my way to the milk station," I stammered. "I will wait for you here," she said, pounding on the face of her wristwatch with a long finger. When I was out of her sight, I took my time examining the trees by the roadside and the last blossoming wild flowers. The line at the station was long, and that was what I told her when I reported back to her, late. I addressed her as Teacher Shan, and she corrected me, telling me to call her Professor Shan. She led me up flights of stairs to her flat on the fifth floor. It did not occur to me that there was anything odd about this. The only thing my mother had warned me about when I had had my first period a month earlier was not to spend time alone with a man. Professor Shan's place, a one-room unit also, seemed more crowded than ours, even though she lived there all by herself. Apart from a table, a chair, and a single bed, the room was filled with trunks, dark leather ones with intricate patterns on the tops and sides, wooden ones with rusty metal clips, and two matching trunks, once bleached, but by then more yellow than white, made of bamboo or perhaps straw, I couldn't tell which. On each trunk there were books. She moved a pile of books to make a spot for me to sit on her single bed, and then took a seat in the only chair in the room. Up to that point, I had not studied her, but I realized now that she was a beautiful woman, even at her age. Her hair, grayish-white, was combed into a tight bun, not a single strand running loose. Her face, the high cheekbones, the very prominent forehead, the deep-set eyes, reminded me of a photograph of a female Soviet pilot in my textbook. I wondered if Professor Shan had some mixed blood. It was a secret joy of mine to study people's faces. I must take after my mother, who, apart from studying my face at a meal, the table placed between the two beds in my parents' bedroom, rarely took a bite. Sometimes, waiting for us to finish eating, she would comment on the people passing by outside our window, oily and puffy as fresh fried dough, she described the woman living a floor above us. The man next door had a long and bitter-looking face like a cucumber. My mother was the prettiest woman I had known until then, with almond-shaped eyes in a small, heart-shaped face, a straight and delicate nose, and, as I later learned from her collection of romantic novels from the early 1900s, a cherry petal mouth. When she grew tired of watching the world, she would study her own face in an oval mirror. A princess trapped in the fate of a handmaiden, she would say to no one in particular. My father, eating silently, would look up at her with an apologetic smile, as if he were a parent responsible for his child's deformed body. My father had married late in his life, my mother early, he at 50 and she at 20. 2 years later, they had me, their only child. When I was in elementary school, other children often mistook him for my grandfather, but perhaps that was because he had to be a parent for my mother too. Together, my mother and I made my father grow old fast. You could see that in his stooped back and sad smile. "Do you always let your mind wander in front of your teachers?" Professor Shen asked, though I could see the question was more an amusement than a criticism. In her youth, she must have been more beautiful than my mother. I wondered what my mother would think if she knew my opinion. One thing I was certain was that my mother would not get along well with Professor Shen, eccentricity being both women's prized possession. I'm going to skip one passage about Professor Shen's history. She used to be married to a man, they had two children, and she sent all three of them to America and was done with them. So this is back to Professor Shen's apartment. She studied me while I looked around the room, then picked up an old book and turned to a random page. "Read the line to me," she said. The book was the first one in a series called Essential English, which Professor Shen had used to learn English 50 years ago. The page had a small cartoon of a child on a seat, the kind one would find in a luxurious theater. In the cartoon, the child, who was not heavy enough to keep the seat from folding back, smiled uncertainly on his high perch, and I felt the same. I had entered middle school earlier that month and had barely learned my alphabet. When I could not read the caption, Professor Shen put the book back with the other volumes, their spines different colors that were equally faded. "You do know that you are not your parents' first daughter, don't you?" She turned and faced me. "And you do know that no matter how nicely they treat you, they can't do much for your education, don't you?" I had not doubted my blood until then. I knew that my parents were different from most parents, but I had thought that it was their age difference and my mother's illness. "Mo Yan," my mother sometimes said my name in a soft voice when my father was not around, and I would know that she had some secrets to tell me. "A man can have children until he's 70, she would say. "A woman's youth ends the moment she marries. Mo Yan, do not let a man touch you, especially here and here," she would say, gesturing vaguely towards her own body. "Mo Yan, your father would get your stepmother the moment I died," she would say, narrowing her eyes in an amused way. "Do you know that I cannot die because I don't want you to live under a stepmother?" In one of these revelatory moments, she could have said, "Mo Yan, you were not born to us. We only picked you up from a garbage dump." But no, my mother had never, even in her most uncharitable moment, said that to me. And in fact, she kept a secret until her death. And for that alone, I loved her and love her still. "If your parents haven't told you this, someone else must," Professor Shen said when I did not reply. One needs to know where she came from. Do you understand? In my confusion, I nodded. I'm fortunate to be slow in responding to news. I have avoided much drama in my life as the impact, if there's any, comes much later in solitary meditation. I was an orphan myself, Professor Shen said. Slowly over the next 3 years, Professor Shen's story would come in full. Her mother, a woman who had stayed unmarried to take care of her own aging parents, had inherited their small china shop when they died. By then, she was too old to get married. She went to a Shanghai orphanage in the deadly winter of 1928 and adopted the only girl who was not suffering pneumonia. She named the young girl Shan Shan. She had no family name, as there was not one she could claim. Mactarian School for Girls, the best school in Shanghai, was where Professor Shan had been educated. The school's name spelled out for me to remember. The Mactarians, the song she and her classmate had sung at school gatherings, sung to me. In her early 20s, Professor Shan had been hired by a teacher's college, but was fired when her dubious history was discovered. People who think they know their own stories do not appreciate other people's mysteries, Professor Shan explained. That is why people like you and me will always find each other. Those words, first said to me in the early days of my visits, are what made me go back to her every day at 5 o'clock. She read to me. She scoffed at my English textbook and told me to start on the first volume of Essential English. She never checked my progress, and after a while I realized it did not make any difference to her that I only look at the illustrations. Instead, she read her collection of novels to me. We began with David Copperfield. She sitting in the only chair in the room, I on the bed. Intimidation kept me focused at first, but sometimes she would look up sharply in mid-sentence to see if my eyes were wandering. I worried that she would find me a fraud and dismiss me. I did not like her or dislike her yet, but I was in shock, unable to process the fact that I was not related by blood to my parents. And Professor Shan's reading voice, with a melody that was not present when we talked, was soothing in a way that my mother's voice never was. Professor Shan would read long passages, stopping only when she seemed pleased, and then translate for me. Her translation seemed shorter than the original English, but even those brief Chinese words gave me a joy that I did not get elsewhere. I'm going to go a little just to another session, but it's still about the parents. When I had entered elementary school, I had been instructed by my father to put down retired early from illness for my mother's occupation. What kind of illness? The teachers would ask. What did she do before she became ill? At first, I did not know how to answer, but by middle school, I became an expert in dealing with people's curiosity. She was a bookkeeper, I would say, the most tedious and lonely job I could come up for her. Lupus was what had been troubling her, I would explain, the name of the disease learned in the fifth grade when a classmate's mother had died from it. The earliest I could remember people commenting on her illness was when I was 4. I was standing in a long line waiting for our monthly egg ration when my father crossed the street to buy rice. What kind of parents would leave a child that small to hold a place in line? Asked someone who must have been new to the neighborhood, and a woman not far behind me replied that my mother was a mental case. Nymphomania was the word Professor Shan had used, and it was from her that I had learned the story of my parents' marriage. At 19, my mother had fallen in love with a married man who had recently moved into the neighborhood. And when the man claimed he had nothing to do with her fantasy, she ran into the street calling his name and telling people she had aborted stray babies for him. They would have locked her up permanently had it not been for my father's marriage proposal. My father, whom people had thought would remain a bachelor for life, went to my mother's parents and asked to take the burden off their hands. Which would you choose for your daughter had you been a mother? Professor Shan asked me. An asylum or an old man? She told me the story not long after I had become a regular visit to her flat. I had stammered, not knowing how to pass the test. Professor Shen then said that it was my mother's good fortune that her parents had given her up to a man who loved her, rather to an asylum. Love makes a man blind, she added. And I wondered if my father's misfortune was transparent to the world. Later, I would realize that my family, my father's reticence, my mother's craziness, and my existence as part of their pretense to be a normal married couple must have been gossip for the neighborhood, and their story sooner or later would have reached me. But when I left Professor Shan's flat that day, I resented her heartlessness. We were only 50 pages into David Copperfield, and I could have easily found an excuse not to go to her flat again. But what good would it have done me? I was no longer my parents' birth child, and their marriage, if it could be called a marriage, was no doubt a pitiful one. I'm going to go a little forward. So this very short passage happened in the army while she was practicing shooting. The civilian world slowly crept in on us in the forms of letters from old school friends and packages of chocolate from parents, memories of childhood holidays and teenage expectations. And in my case, Professor Shan's voice, reading D.H. Lawrence, her tone unhurried. Well, Mabel, and what are you going to do with yourself? When I closed my eyes at the shooting range, I could hear her voice and the question posed from one character to another now seemed to request an answer for me. Or else, to her father, she was the princess. To her Boston aunts and uncles, she was just Dolly Urquhart, poor little thing. I'm going to go to the next quote. Again, it's Professor Shan's voice. People don't know what they're doing and saying. They chatter, chatter, and they hurt one another, and they hurt themselves very often till they cry. At night, I try to remember Professor Shan's voice when she read her favorite story to me. And when I was not sure if I remembered exact words, I turned on my flashlight and reread the story under the quilt. But don't take any notice, my little princess. We had spent 10 months with David Copperfield, slowly at first, 2 or 3 pages a day, and later 5 or 6 pages. I don't remember at what point I had begun to understand what was read to me. It must be similar to the moment a child first understands the world in words, when what is spoken to her has not yet taken on a definite meaning, but she becomes more confident each day that there is message behind those jumbled sounds. I told my parents that I had been visiting Professor Shan, that she had agreed to tutor me, a lie that my father had not questioned and my mother had not bothered to listen to. I did not tell Professor Shan that I began to understand her, but surely she saw the change. Perhaps my eyes wandered less often, or perhaps my face betrayed an eagerness where before was only ignorance. In any case, 2/3 into the novel, she stopped translating for me. Neither of us talked about this change of routine. I was quiet, still intimidated by her, though I had begun to look forward to the hours spent in her flat. She had not begun to tell me her stories. That would come later. I had not begun to share her attachment to books. That, too, would come later, much later, perhaps only after I stopped visiting her. Still, her fifth-floor flat, where life did not seem to be lived out in the measuring of rice and flour or the counting of paper bills and coins, at least during the time I was there, became a place that no other place could be. Strangers, closer to my heart than my neighbors and my acquaintances, loved tragic and strange loves and died tragic and strange deaths. And Professor Shan's unperturbed voice made it all seem natural. Looking back, I wonder if it was because of my limited understanding of the language that all tragedies became acceptable to me. Perhaps all the time I was imagining a different story. After David Copperfield, we read Great Expectations, then the return of the Native, and later Tess of D'Urbervilles. It was during the Jew the Obscure that she began to tell me her story, in fragments I would piece together later. Sometimes the story came at the beginning of the afternoon, sometimes when she took a break from reading the novel to me. She never talked long about herself, and afterwards we did not discuss. I had become less nervous around her. Still, I did not talk much about my life at school or at home. Intuitively, I knew she had little interest in the life I lived outside the hour in her flat. So I'm going to go jump a little bit forward to the time when she was in the army and she returned for a holiday. In late January, 3 days after the Lunar New Year, I left home to return to the army. I did not tell my parents that there was still another week until the holiday leave ended, nor did I inform anyone at the camp of my decision to return early. "Would you like me to see you off at the train station?" my mother asked when I came into her bedroom to say goodbye. She was leaning against a sack of pillows on her bed, an old novel, its pages yellow and fragile, resting on her chest as if her hands were no longer strong enough to lift the book. She had become less careful with her looks, strands of hair going astray, pajamas worn all day long, where before she had always dressed herself at dawn. She looked frailer, too. On the day I returned from the army, she had seemed happy to see me. "There was no need," I replied. My father, standing in the doorway with a bag in his hand, waited for us to finish our farewell. In the bag, he had packed, head to end, 2 dozen pickled eggs, wrapped up neatly in 4 columns of newspapers. I had told him not to bother with the eggs, but he insisted that I looked ill-fed. "So, you're doing well in the army?" my mother asked. I said that all was well. I had noticed upon returning that my mother would sometimes make an effort to chat with me. But her interest was fleeting, and she was easily tired or bored by me. So eventually we set up into the old mode, conversations between us polite and formal. My father, too, seemed to cling to my presence more than before. In the mornings when he returned home from the night shift, he would pick up 2 pieces of fried bread from the street peddler and watch me eat them before they turned cold. The previous day, he insisted on accompanying me when I went to the stores to buy a few things for the camp, looking away when I asked the clerk for sanitary napkins. Had they missed me while I was gone? I could not tell. My parents had always been quiet around each other, simple household communications transmitted not by words. My father, upon returning from work in the morning, would brew the tea and hand a cup to my mother, who would by then have groomed and dressed herself. When breakfast was ready, he would place her plate first on the table, and she would join us without having to be reminded, though she rarely touched the food. My father would nap from mid-morning to early afternoon, and my mother left the flat when he slept. I never knew where she went, but she always came back and rested in bed when my father got up to finish the day's chores. When she became weaker, she no longer took long walks while my father napped. They must have talked to each other, but mostly there was silence between them, a comfort more than a reason for resentment. I believe to this day that despite its cruelty, fate granted them the best companions they could have asked for in a marriage. They knew what they needed from each other, and they did not request what they could not have. My mother told me to come closer to her bed. My father nodded at me in a pleading way, and she told me to bend over so she could have a good look at my face. So her face was all frostbitten in the army camp in the winter. She touched my cheeks where the frostbitten skin was now puffy and tender with a yellowish hue. "Look what they did to you," my mother said, as if she had noticed it for the first time. "The frostbite is getting better," I said, and then asked my father if it was time for us to go. "Things get better or else they get worse," my mother said. "You should learn to take care of your face. You're prettier than you let yourself believe." "I don't mind looking ugly," I said. "You should know that you can't possibly be ugly because you are my daughter." She was almost inaudible. Later, I wondered if she meant that she would not have adopted a homely-looking baby, or if perhaps on a whim, she wanted to claim my blood connection to her. She seemed to have other things to say, but when I said goodbye, she only laughed lightly. "Typical for a young girl to be in a hurry," she said, and then waved for my father and me to leave her alone. So she went away to the army camp, and that was in January. And in May, she got a telegram asking to go back to Beijing right away because her mother died. My father looked a very old man, his eyes hollow, his hands shaking constantly, the grief too heavy. He had turned 70 the day before my mother's death, a suicide I had guessed at once, though he did not tell me what she had done. It was from neighbors that I found out she had hanged herself in the bedroom. Anybody else would have broken that curtain rod with her weight. But of course, your mother was so skinny, an old woman said to me, as if my mother's only misfortune was that she had never become a nicely plump woman. "Your mother was the kindest woman in the world," my father said the night before her cremation. He was lying in bed, his head propped up by the stack of pillows my mother had used when she read. I told him to eat a little and then rest, but the noodle soup I had made for him remained untouched, and he insisted on watching me pack up my mother's side of the bedroom. Her clothes, many of them from her youth, were to be cremated with her. Her collections of novels and Asian poetry I was to put into boxes and moved out to the foyer. My father, like uneducated people in his generation, revered anything in print. He told me to keep the books that I should use them as I continue my education. She was never happy to be married to an old man, he said, but she kept her promise. I did not know what promise my father was talking about, but I knew I did not press him for an explanation. In the past 2 days, he talked more than he had for years, stories of my mother's childhood and youth, of being the middle daughter sandwiched between many siblings and feelings neglected by her parents, of loving books despite her parents' decision to send her to a factory as an apprentice at 15, of her favorite three-legged cat named Sansan, of her delight in painting her fingernails with petals of balsam every spring, red or pink or lavender, depending on which color was blooming in her best friend's garden. All this was related to me. I wonder if my mother had told my father these stories in the early years of their marriage, but she had already been a mad woman then, so how could he have been certain that she was not just making up tales the same way she had made up her love story with a married man? She asked me if 20 years was enough, my father said after a moment. 20 years was a long time for an older man like me, I told her. So she said, let's be husband and wife for 20 years. People said I was out of my mind to marry a mad woman, but you see, she was only unhappy. She did not break her promise. I placed a romance novel on top of a pile quietly. I wonder if my mother had calculated all out. An older man in love with her was better than an asylum or the ruin of her disgraced parents and siblings. But no matter, she had returned his kindness with 20 years of a life she had no desire to live. Of course, it's not fair for you, Mo Yan, my father said. I thought 20 years enough time to bring up a child together. She did not want you at first. Why did she agree? A child gives a marriage a future. That was what people told me. I thought when we had you, she would forget that foolish deal of 20 years, my father said, his voice so low I could barely hear him. I'm sorry we haven't had much to offer you as parents. I turned my back to my father, pretending to pick up another stack of books so he could not see my tears. Neither he nor I, in the end, had given her more reason to live than the obligation to fulfill a simple promise, though even in her maddest years, she hadn't given up the pretense that she was my birth mother. I wished Professor Shen had never told me about my adoption. The next day, my father and I saw my mother off. There was no memorial service for her, nor did any of her siblings come and acknowledge her departure. My father insisted on waiting by the furnace alone, so I wandered into one of the meeting halls and sat through a memorial service for a stranger. On the bus ride home, my father carried a wooden box, inside of which was an ivory-colored silk bag that contained what was left of my mother. I tried to convince him to bury her in the municipal cemetery, but he had refused. He wanted to be buried with her on the same day, he explained to me. Not right next to her, he said, since she had fulfilled her promise, and he should fulfill his promise of leaving her alone. But also not too far from her, he added after a moment. I'm sorry we have to burden you, my father said, when I said nothing about his request. I knew that he had guessed by then that I'd found out about my adoption, as one's birth father would not have to apologize for his own last request. I'm going to go to the just a couple pages. This is after the funeral. A few weeks later, after I had come home, I was standing by the roadside, and Professor Shen approached me. I see that you're back, she said. Come with me. I had not been to Professor Shen's flat since I had left her, yet from the look of things, time had stopped in her world. I heard about your mother's passing, Professor Shen said, and signaled me to sit down on her bed. Is your father doing all right? A few days earlier, my father had asked me if I thought he had been responsible for my mother's death. Would she have had a longer life if he had not married her, he asked me. And I assured him that my mother, despite her unhappiness, loved him as she had never loved anyone else. Love makes one in debt, Professor Shen said. I nodded, though I wondered whether she meant that my father was forever paying back his debt to my mother because of his love for her, or that being loved and unable to love back had made her indebted to him. Best if you start free from all that, do you understand? Professor Shen said. I had read enough love stories to be interested in one more, I said, and Professor Shen seemed satisfied by my answer. After that, I resumed my daily visit to her flat, and I continued for the next 12 years. At the beginning, she read to me, and later, when her eyesight deteriorated, I took over, though she was always the one to tell me which book to read. She never asked me about my life in the army, and she showed little interest in the civilian life I led in college and later as a school teacher. When I reached marriage age, people began to press me, subtly at first and later less so. Professor Shen must have suspected all this talk, but as always, she refused to let the mundane into her flat. Instead, we read other people's stories, more real than our own. After all, inadequate makers of our own lives, we were no match for those masters. My father died less than a year after my mother, and against his wish, I buried their urns next to each other. I visit them every year on my birthday, my only trip outside the district where I live and teach. My mother fell in love at an early age, my father late. They both fell for someone who would not return their love. Yet in the end, their love story is the only love story I can claim. And I live as a proof of that story, of one man's offering to a woman from his meager existence, and of her returning it with her entire adult life. I'm going to go, I think, just one more passage to the end, to the present moment. I now memorize ancient poems from my mother's books. I reread the romantic stories and never tire of them. They are terrible stories, terribly written. Yet they are about fate, a kinder fate that unites one with her lover, despite hardships and improbability. And they never fail to give me a momentary hope, as they must have given my mother years ago, as if all will be well in the end. But it is Professor Shen's collection that I truly live with, Dickens and Hardy and Lawrence, who once saw me as a young girl and who will one day see me as an old woman. The people who live out their lives in those books, like their creators, are not my people. And I wonder if it is this irrelevance that makes it easier for me to wander among them, the same way that now being related to my parents by blood makes it easy for me to claim their love story as mine. The girls I served with in the army must be mothers and wives by now. I imagine them continuing with their daily lives, unaware of Lieutenant Wei's death. I have never forgotten any person who has come into my life. This is about a character I didn't read. As I'm on my way to work this morning, I see Nan's face on a TV screen at shop window. I watch her through the glass pane. I cannot hear what the program is saying, but the way she smiles and talks, you can tell she's an important person. I study her, still petite and beautiful, still able to pass for a young woman in a choir. For a moment, my heart mourns for the passing of time as it had never mourned the deaths of my parents or Professor Shen or Lieutenant Wei. If I close my eyes, I can hear again Nan's beautiful voice singing the last rose of summer at the shooting range, a random act of kindness that will continue living on in the memory of someone who is a stranger to her by now. That's it. Thank you very much.
Concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you for the beautiful reading. I think we were both saying off stage that you almost made us cry. And I think you said that you almost made yourself cry.
A little bit, yes. I was afraid I was going to lose my voice.
I wanted to start by asking you about the beginning of the story, and specifically about William Trevor,
yes,
who you've mentioned as an influence, and I know with this story that it borrows from the beginning of one of his books.
Yes. So I always consider, you know, William Trevor, the Irish storyteller, you know, short story and writer and novelist, as my mentor. I feel that I learned writing by reading him. For years and years, I've been reading him. And in a way, I think of my writing as this way. You know, you don't talk to your favorite author every day. I can't call Trevor every day and say, "What's up?" So the way I can talk to him is through writing. And specifically, in recent stories, I started to write in a way that I would have an idea, and I would choose one story that Trevor has written, and I would read the story, and then I would write the story in conversation with that story. So Kindness, it's a novella, and I had this idea writing about this woman's life in first-person narrative, but I had the whole story mapped in my mind, but I couldn't start because I did not. I just felt I did not have that voice right. And there was a novella by Trevor called The Night at Alexandra. And I don't know if you have read that novella. It's a beautiful novella about this Irish boy, teenage boy, in the 1940s in this small Irish town. And an English woman married to a German man because they felt uncomfortable living in both Britain and Germany. So they moved to Ireland, moved to this small Irish town. And this young boy sort of had an infatuation with the woman, but also became very close to the husband. And one thing about the husband and woman, and husband and wife in that story, was they're an older man, a younger woman. So I thought, when I had the idea of writing this novella, I thought that this novella would be a novella talking to his novella. And in a way, I imagined that my characters in real life, in this reality, would have never met his characters. But my character would talk to his character in this fictional world. So that novella started with, I am a 50-year-old man living in a provincial town. I have never married. I don't have children. So that's Trevor's opening. And I thought I would directly borrow that opening, writing my story. And then right after the first paragraph, it just became very natural that, in a way, I think the woman was talking to the other narrator in Trevor's novella, in a way sharing her story about, you know, love and loneliness and her reflection about her life versus the man's reflection about his life. And that's how the story or the novella came about. And I'm just very happy about that. And I think it's the best I can do for a writer I love.
Mm-hmm. And is happiness something that they would have talked about with each other?
Yes. You know, happiness, it's very interesting. I don't think the narrator in Trevor's novella would be called a happy man by the standard of happiness. But several times he said he was very happy because he had this memory of this man, this woman. And he lived on with that memory. So sort of, I think they would convince each other, my character and his character would convince each other they were the happiest people in the world. Because I think they both have something that are very hard for us to understand, but they are very true to them, and they stayed true with that feeling. So, yes, I think both of them would be happy, and they would be happier if they met each other.
But I'm trying to think how to ask this question. For you writing the story, did you, as their creator, as their author, want struggle with their unhappiness? Did you want, and with the bleakness of their lives, and especially, mm-hmm. and I think this is the first time you've written in first person, so
yes.
Presumably that means you were much closer to
right.
these characters.
Right. So the question is?
Well, I'm just wondering how you thought about happiness
right.
and unhappiness writing the story, or if that matters to the story.
It matters to me that, I mean, there are different kinds of happiness. Like for me, it makes me happy to be able to write, to talk to Trevor, despite all the unhappiness of the stories. But also, I think, you know, I was talking to some of the students yesterday too. I was reading an essay by Elizabeth Bowen, and she said, you know, when young writers first started writing, they write to be felt. But inconsequential, I mean, she said that 9 out of 10 writers stay in that stage, just they write to be felt. Well, there's the consequence, the most important writer, they move on to the next stage. And I was talking to the students, I said, you know, I think that urge to be felt is in everybody. You know, we talk, we communicate because we want people to understand you. But as a writer, it's not like I write to be felt for you or for the by the readers, mm-hmm. but more important to me is I write to feel that character. I think the characters want to be felt. And my effort is to get as close to those feelings as possible. And of course, you know, it's a bleak story. You know, we talk about bleakness and darkness. I mean, bleakness, I have to say, I'm very drawn to bleakness, which is terrible, no? But there is a difference between bleakness and darkness. And I don't think my stories, I mean, or this story, I don't think life is dark for them. There's always some sort of, you know, hope or love or warmth they hold on to. And I was just, we were talking about, earlier we were talking about, you know, waiting in the marketplace to buy food. When I was a child, like I always followed my father, like the character, to the marketplace. And like eggs were rationed, so every Sunday, there was a long line of people waiting for eggs. But you realize, you know, eggs were breakable. Eggs were not sturdy. So some of the eggs would break before they were sold. And these eggs, they could not be sold, you know, for that ration. So the salespeople would put eggs in a basin. And they would, you know, gather probably 10 eggs. Before they would sell that at a cheaper price without a ration ticket to someone. The interesting thing is, you know, there was a long line of people waiting. They would never tell you who they were going to sell the mm-hmm. eggs to. They kept you waiting. Everybody was waiting in suspense. And then, I think that's just the powerful, you know, magic finger. They would look around, they would point at a man or a woman said, "Do you want those eggs?" And the person would say, yes, yes, yes. You know, that's the luckiest person in the world. When I was a child, I always hoped my father would be picked, but he never was picked. And it was quite bleak. But I think the bleakness actually was not with, you know, my father never getting picked. But it was with all these people around. Everybody was jealous about that person who got the eggs. Or everybody was, you know, but these people standing in line, they would not communicate. They would not think we're in the same boat, we share the same feeling. No, there's no communication there. That's the bleakness, I think, mm-hmm. of life. But darkness. Oh, wait, do I have to talk about darkness?
Okay, well,
I just realized I'm
we
like...
We can talk about lightness.
Well, lightness. Hmm. I think darkness is a little bit different. I told Bridget I it's really hard for me to be to talk, like, to make sense, so I have to tell stories. And the same story, when we would go into the marketplace, there was a bus stop next to the marketplace, and there would be a bus coming. I saw this when I was young, and an older woman, I mean older man, was just running, trying to catch that bus, panting. And the conductor, just a young man, he would, you know, lean out of the window. He would look with a smile. And the moment when the old man reached the door, he hit the button, and the door banged close to the old man's face. And then the bus drove away. He said, bye-bye. That, to me, is darkness. If, you know, I would never want to be that old man with the door banged to my face. I feel that is the darkness. But darkness, you know, it's injustice, you know. But there was a villain there. That conductor was the villain. But the bleakness, there's no real villains in bleakness. Sorry, that's such a long answer.
The good one. I know you've talked elsewhere, and it's part of sort of your official story as a writer, that you didn't start writing until you came to the States and were able to write in English. But the way you talk about China and the ways you observed the people around you growing up, that seems sort of the eyes and the mind of a storyteller. So why was it that it wasn't until you came here that you were able to start writing?
Right. You know, feel so bad. I have this official story now.
You can't escape it.
I know. But, you know, despite it's the official story, it's a still true story. I had never written in Chinese. And, I mean, as a young girl, I did keep a little journal. But as I told, you know, when you wrote in a journal, my mother was the nosiest woman in the world. I knew she would look for my journal, and she would read whatever I wrote in that journal, and there was no lock in my whole house. That was another thing. I did not grow up with a lock. So what I did with Chinese was I would write around things. I would say the things that I would write around the things. So the example would be, you know, if I wanted to write about a bird, I would not say the bird. I would say there's a tree. There's the cloud, the sky, you know, I would leave the shape of the bird there, which is terrible, I said, for a storyteller. And when I came to the country and I thought I wanted to try writing, you realize, you know, first of all, my mother doesn't read English. And that's the key for my being a writer, is my mother doesn't read English. And it's just, you came into this language as a grown-up without any history. I think just without any history is very important for me. And I started writing just to say what I wanted to say. So that is, I think, why English becomes such a natural language for me to tell stories.
And do you think, I mean, now that you've been living here for 12 years or a little longer and writing for 12 years in English, has your writing changed? Do you see a difference between the first book and the third book? And I know I'm cheating a little because...
Yes, you know it has changed. Yes, I think... Again, you know, this is just returning to my previous comment about, you know, younger writers start writing by wanting to be felt. And I think with my first book... You know, I wasn't autobiographical in the way that, you know, none of the stories was my story or my parents' story or my family's story. But in a way, I could remember, especially with some of the stories like Immortality, Persimmons, about very social life in China. I felt I had this little voice in my mind saying, I need to write these stories so you can understand what China is like, what the China I grew up in, what the country is like.
So that American readers
So American
understand.
Readers okay. would understand. I think especially with very early stories, some of the stories you read earlier on, I think had those moments that I really, really want you to understand me. But now, I think moving on, you know, after the novel, after another collection of stories, it's really not like... I really want you, the reader, to understand me, as I want to feel my characters, and if I can present their world to you in a way that you can feel with me, not feel me, but feel with me, that will be good. So I think because I have that, and because I'm so drawn to bleakness and sadness in the world, I think my stories are becoming less spokesperson ish. Does that make sense? And like, I don't want to be calmless.
You don't want to be a spokesperson, right? Right.
Right. I don't want to be a spokesperson for any part of, you know, China or Chinese history or, you know, my people or anything. But I just want to approach one story, one character at a time.
I mean, I know that's something that you're often asked about as a writer, to speak about China and politics, and I think especially for American readers, that's mm-hmm. very much how we think of China, mm-hmm. and that it's something you always resist. More, mm-hmm. I mean, more and more as time passes.
Yes.
And I know in the magazine where we published your story, you also translated a portfolio of letters by a Chinese writer, Shen Songwen.
Yes.
And can I just read a brief paragraph from your introduction and then ask you to talk about that sort of
yes.
in the context of being a spokesperson versus being a fiction writer. Shen Songwen wrote in the 40s and 50s. And you say, like Chekhov, his favorite writer, Shen wrote about his characters, riverside prostitutes, a mother and daughter eking out a living in a mill, an old man in charge of a ferry bringing up a granddaughter born out of wedlock, and many others. peasants, soldiers, fishermen, landlords, army officers, with a love and kindness that stood out in his time. It also exposed him to criticism from leftist writers for his disinterest in politics and lack of commitment to the class struggles of the time. Relevance is always a useful tool for lesser minds to attack true artists. And how do you think about that question of relevance for yourself and for fiction in general?
Such a big question. I need to form my thesis statement here. I don't understand relevance. That doesn't help. Well, I think relevance in a way, like, you want to, like, I would just use Shen Chong Wen as an example why I think relevance is not important or irrelevance is important. So when he started writing was in the 1920s and 30s. He came from this very small town in southern China, and he really wrote the people he knew very well with so much kindness. And the thing is, he knew, like, warlords were not villains in his stories. Landlord could fall in love with a young girl, peasant girl, and the love story could still be a good love story. And those things were not allowed in China in his time. And even before communism took over China, he was heavily attacked because he was interested in, I would say, the human nature, that was the timeliness of human nature. That was what he wrote about. But relevance, it's about time. It's about the present moment. Relevance, I think, you know, they have to have something to do with now, at this moment. So at his time, the writer said, you were beautifying the landlords, you were beautifying the warlords, you were beautifying the people who were the controlling classes, or the classes that did all these horrible things. That was not right. And so his opposite would be like storyteller like Lu Xun, who really had this goal to write with an agenda, as, you know, they have to expose the evil and they have to do the right to the people or to China. And that's just killing art. You know, Shen Chong Wen himself stopped writing right after communism took over China. He never returned to writing. He lived on for 50 years, knowing he would never be able to be a fiction writer again because he was an irrelevant person the whole life. And what a sad story. You know, in a way, I would rather be an irrelevant writer than saying I have to write about now, this moment, what happens with the economic crisis, or, you know, what happened. I actually, talking about relevance and irrelevance, I went to a school to give a reading, and this young woman from China, again, you know, that's relevance. She came to me, she's 19 at the time, she was 19 at the time, and just coming to America for college. And she said, you know, as a Chinese person, I know the stories you write about China are true. But as a good person, you know, can I ask you, as a good person, can you write about the Olympics? That is relevance. I mean, to her, China in 2008, with all this fanfare of being a strong country, that was very relevant. I said, I'm sorry. You know, I can't write for you for that. That'll be propaganda. So no, I want to be irrelevant. I want to stay timeless.
I started by asking you about William Trevor, and I want to end by asking you about other writers that you write to talk with. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So if you don't know me, I'm a kind of an odd person. I talk to books all the time. And when I read a book, if I'm mad at the author, I would write, no, 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 on the page. Or I would say, wow, I make all sorts of comments to talk to writers. But I think in a way, because Bridget and I, you know, we've been friends for so long, and we, most of the time we spend talking with, like, we argue with each other. We would find a disagreement and we argue. And I think that's so important for a writer to be able to disagree with someone. And I acknowledge that I have the limit with Trevor's work is I agree with him all the time. Everything he writes is perfect to me. I don't criticize him. So in a way, I talk to him, but I don't argue with him. I don't disagree with him. So you know it's very important to have a bunch of writers you can disagree with or argue with. And some of the writers, like, I have been disagreeing with or arguing with or agreeing with in the past year includes Elizabeth Bowen, V.S. Pritchett, Iris Murdoch. I yelled at her all the time. I really did. I disagree with her all the time. And sometimes, like, she would make a comment. Like, for instance, she made this comment that baffled me. She said, you have to correct me if I said it wrong, she said, it's immoral to fall in love with someone you don't like.
Right.
Is that the quote?
That is what she said.
I spent a few days thinking about that. I disagreed with her. And I yelled at her. I thought that's the wrong thing to say. No, but my goal is I'm going to write a story to disagree with her, saying, you are wrong. It's a very moral thing to fall in love with someone you don't like. That's my goal. So those are kind of things I would do. Yes, you write stories to agree and disagree with other authors. With Elizabeth Bowen, too, I'm very attracted, you know, to her work. But in a way, I notice that her characters oftentimes have this really heightened awareness of their existence, sometimes very unnatural. And in a way, I think even though I like her stories and her novels, my writing is a way to disagree with her. You know, my characters do not have that heightened awareness. But they can still feel and they can still, I don't know, just go on, live their lives in a less dramatic way.
Mm-hmm. Those are all Irish and British writers. Does that mean that you feel a special kinship with them? Something about them reminds you of Chinese characters?
Yes. I feel, we have this joke that, like, Irish writers are really Chinese writers. And, or Irish people are really Chinese. And I do feel kinship, like, to a lot of Irish writers, like William Trevor and John McGaughan. I love his work. And Elizabeth Bowen, Molly Keane, another, you know, older Irish writer. Something about their work, about how characters in their work, how they talk all the time without saying what they want to say.
Right.
I don't know if
it's a very Chinese trait as well as a very Irish trait.
It's a very Irish trait, you know, and it's a Chinese trait too. That I notice that my family, we can never have a moment of silence. We have to talk nonstop without saying anything. So, and then, you know, you read all these Irish writers, the stories are often like people live on the surface. Well, there are dramas and underneath the surface. And I think that's probably part of the reason I'm really drawn to Irish writers and how they can write about that deception and self-deception and all these layers of truth underneath the surface so well.
Well, thank you. That was wonderful.
Thank you very much. It's so fun to talk to you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.